So usually what we do is we joke and laugh about something for a couple minutes, which doesn't work, and then we get into the introductions, but we can just get started in. So welcome to Confessions of a Game Dev podcast. We've got some special guests on with us today, and this is Spence Buchanan.
Brandon Karate.
Ashley McMillan.
And today we have...
Clark Stacy,
and not to be overshadowed by the awesomeness of Isaac.
Yep.
Isaac would do. Isaac showed up today. So we're going to introduce Isaac and Clark in just a second here. Hey, let's do it right now.
All right. There, just a second. All right.
So this podcast we're gonna gab at Clark because he is the are you a CEO is that right
yeah
of Smart Bum Interactive. We've had Josh and Peter come on, and so we've talked about Animal Jam in the past, but we'd love to get to know the man behind the machine.
Animal
there.
Jam and ninjutsu probably. And Peter, you had.
We learned about the ninja. So, and Adam Hunter was on, and he apparently calls you King Triton without a beard. So I'm not sure what that reference is.
Well, Adam,
if it's to your physique or
Adam has a rich inner life, as you probably observe. I think it shows our commitment to diversity. No level of mental illness is. There's a bar to work with for Smart Bomb.
and he did warn me. He said, you have a silver tongue. I don't know if that's a bad thing or a good thing, but because we usually go on for 2 hours anyways, so...
Rather not.
We'll try not to. We'll try to keep this into a reasonable time frame, but...
Wow. Should I be worried that Adam has all these colorful... lyrical.
I see. I don't know. He admitted himself that he's a Murrayologist and a devout member of Bill Murray's... I don't know what that is.
Study of Bill Murray.
So
yeah, but Bill Murray doesn't talk about me like that.
Though. Yeah, no, of course not. I'm not sure. We need a. Do you know Bill Murray?
I don't know. Oh. That's why. I'm
probably... Okay. Well, so before Sharks. We get into almost the there. Awesomeness of Clark, Isaac, you want to introduce yourself because we try to bring on new people all the time, and Isaac can be a regular.
All right. Well, I'm Isaac. Yes, and I'm a character artist and just mainly do a lot of modeling action work for you guys over doing the 3D printer.
Yes.
So I print off a lot of stuff, just do nonstop 3D stuff.
And you're in the undergrad program at the U of U. Number one program in the nation or something.
It's pretty cool, you know. I'm not going to say it was only me, but majority.
Cool. That's why we brought Isaac on.
Awesome. So I'm curious, Clark, what have you done before... Smart Bomb. Like, what got you into the game industry to be one of these stalwart leaders in this?
I don't know about that, but I attended the University of Utah studying English literature and philosophy, and apparently this is what you do with those credentials.
Sure.
Start a company?
If you were wondering, go to the philosophy building. Those are the people that you're going to be working for someday.
Oh, that's good.
I had started out in that direction. I thought that academia was probably the path that I was going on. I was interested in working with the classics department here and had partnered with a professor in languages and literature. We were working on some books and research together that were a lot of fun, and a friend of mine, a guy whose bar I had started bouncing in at 19, had started a game company. It's what he had been born to do and always dreamed of doing, and he was an amazingly gifted self-taught programmer, and I started helping him out with that, and it sort of transitioned to us becoming partners and eventually forming Smart Bomb together.
So Smart Bomb was your is your first venture into...
No, our first one was Beyond Games, which is a company that he founded and I joined, okay. And so we ran that for about 10 years, and then founded Smart Bomb. In between, we'd started another company called Cobalt Interactive, doing Adver games. I'd started a web development company in Utah, believe it or not, back in, like, 1993, that turned out to be a little premature.
Wow. That's really ambitious.
Yeah. yeah, I mean, at home at night, I'd playing, like, text-based MUDs, but I thought we'd get a web-based company off the ground here. You know,
Did you grow up playing video games? I mean, was that something like, oh, I love video games, or you're just like, sure, whatever, this sounds like a good opportunity?
I did, you know. Chris Johnson, who's our chief operating officer, really our technical architect, and he was the guy whose company I joined. Mm-hmm. He's somebody who had just known that he was going to do this all his life. My goal has really been more about writing and storytelling, and that's why I've gone into the very fruitful pursuits of English literature and philosophy, and you know, guaranteed job market that those provide. So really, for me, it was the storytelling medium that drew me here. But I had been playing. Yeah, I still have my Magnavox Odyssey that has.
Nice. Oh my gosh!
And it's not the one that, you know, you plug different games in. It's the one that has like three joysticks that are built into thing. And yeah, it has three different games, all of which are Pong.
No, wait, was that the Odyssey? Is not the one with the different screens, was it? That you peel off the screens and put them on the TV screen.
No.
What is that one that I'm thinking?
I know what you're talking about.
Because that's one that they're. Did you play that game yesterday at the EAE day that they're patterning that off of, where it's a game without rules?
I think that was a later version of the Odyssey.
Okay, maybe it was. Okay, because I thought it was the Odyssey, but
yeah.
This one had built-in controllers.
Yeah,
nice.
No, this was like 74 or something.
Man, that's crazy.
Yeah.
So, favorite game of all time.
Wow. I'm
just going to rush you with that one.
Yeah, let's just get it out of the way, right?
You know, I came in because of a passion for game design, and I would have to say, and I hear this from other game designers too, that the original XCOM UFO Defense.
Yeah.
That was something that it was completely unlike anything that I'd played before. It seemed to just have a, you know, seen turn-based strategy, seen other things like this. But the way that the story and the tension was created there, it was really novel, and it really got me thinking that this really was a storytelling medium and not just, you know, a toy business.
Yeah. But did MUDs feel like stories to you?
Very. You know, very depraved stories mostly, but yeah, absolutely. I mean, there were some great. At the time, we were playing a lot of BBS games. Mm-hmm. You know, yep. You dial in with your modem and like in more games, and you play a little text-based game, or and those. You know, there was. You kind of got the sense that these online communities were possible in those, and then it was weird because like in. A period of a week, the internet just went to hell. It did. I mean, it was all this, you met all these amazing people, had all these amazing conversations online, and then all of a sudden you started seeing these addresses from AOL.com.
Yep.
And it was like somebody opened the booby hatch and all these ninnies came running into the internet. It was weird. We had been having this wonderful intellectual discussion, and things went downhill.
Did you just pinpoint the dawn of the troll? Is that what I'm hearing?
Yeah,
kind of,
pretty much. You know,
I remember my AOL address.
Yeah,
I think I know which one it is too. Oh, what, Chubby?
No, Hamster Lover.
Oh, right.
Oh, that's right.
It's terrible.
That'll haunt you.
I was a little girl when that happened.
Try explaining that to the internet.
I know. I've already gotten enough crap from these guys.
Oh, gosh.
I'm proud to say I don't have an AOL account, but I actually remember what it is, so I'm going to keep my mouth quiet and hope no one gets mad.
It's better than Hamster Lover?
Yeah, no. It's,
Hamster Lover, like 33 or whatever?
No, it's 2007. But,
I'm just going to hear this and dig it up.
You don't.
We're going to find you.
Yeah. No, it's not like I access this account ever. Definitely.
Yep. I had this with my dial up.
You're accessing your AOL account?
I'm off the grid as far as AOL knows. And off the grid.
within a week, somebody on 4chan is going to be using your AOL address.
Hey, there you go. Look what I found. Oh, goodness.
That's why I'm not saying what it is. So, you guys are working on you showed us a really cool game. Can you talk about that on your phone?
Yeah. So when we first conceived Animal Jam, when we first started building it, we knew that we were going to be making a 2D game, that it was going to be mostly Flash based, because we wanted to be running on everything, right? Yeah. But our genes were in console development. That's what we've been doing, and we wanted to prepare for what was coming next, which we felt was browser-based 3D and console quality gaming in the browser. So even when Animal Jam was first built and first launched, all the characters were built and animated in 3D, and we export out 2D animation.
Oh, really? Flash. I didn't know that.
Very cool. So we get a nice look to the characters from that, but also it means that we've got high-res 3D models articulated for TV animation, for commercials, for anything else we want to do, including taking them into Unity and doing other types of games. So the first of those is a game called Tunnel Town, which is a game in which the rabbits of Jamah, our fictional world, have been sucked into this portal by their nemesis, the Phantoms, and they've been transported to a world where they actually have to work for a living and learn how to do real rabbiting, like digging and growing food and all the stuff. They can't just go to cocktail parties like they did in Jabal and wear tuxedos. So now they're kind of in this world, and the idea behind it is that I hesitate to call it Minecraft Lite, but it kind of is. It's sort of the way that we see people play it. So you've got a surface world where you can grow some food, but really the action is underground, and you start out with a tiny little tunnel, and then you can dig and dig and dig through strata and create rooms and design chambers and stairways and halls, and I mean you're building your world, you're carving it out of this out of the earth, and you're digging down deeper and deeper in different strata, and it becomes harder to dig, and you need you mine gems that you find, and but pretty soon, you being a rabbit from Jamah, you're a sophisticate, you're a bon vivant, you're a rabbit about town, and you're going to want some furniture, you're going to want some comforts of home in there, and you're going to want a dance floor. And
as you do, yeah.
which I loved when you showed me the dance floor was active,
right?
So actively being used at the time.
Yeah. So we have this breeding mechanic where you can arrive at stranger and stranger varieties of rabbits by combining them on the dance floor, which
disco ball and smoke.
Yeah, so you put two rabbits on the dance floor, and tip the DJ, and 8 hours later, you've got an egg that a different species of rabbit will come out with. And so National Geographic was thrilled that we were furthering natural education.
I'm sure.
Wait a minute, eggs?
So that's where babies come from.
Yeah, they come from the dance.
That's why they're Cadbury eggs. Oh, you know, that's
you're eating a little life.
You're eating a little baby.
I finished off a bag of those. I feel terrible.
I was impressed because when I saw you navigating, I'm like, oh, this feels like Tiny Towers upside down. Right, it kind of had that sense, but it felt more freeform and not as like I need to economically build every room to make the most amount of money. It felt very much like I can play and I can enjoy what I'm doing in this space.
Yeah, it is much more open. I mean, there's some goals that we give you to encourage you to explore the world and create new shit. But really, it's about creatively what do you come up with, and we're looking forward to it. Going wide just to see what kids do with it. Really, we've got a lot of strange people in the office, like Adam and Peter. we could see what people in the office are doing with it creatively, and it's fantastic. And I think when kids get their hands on it, it'll be great. So that's in soft launch in Canada right now, and it should be worldwide by the end of May.
Nate, you mentioned that we were talking yesterday. You talked a little about the Canadian soft launch market and also New Zealand.
Yeah.
Which I read an article last night that was like, New Zealand's the place to be. And I was like, my gosh, this is totally what Clark was saying. So.
Yeah, I don't know. Yeah, that was something that that Scott at Eatsley played and had told me because they were testing their game there.
Yeah.
But what we've found anyway is that New Zealand's one of the best territories for Animal Jam anywhere. In terms of a player's likelihood to come into the game and decide they love it and buy memberships and stick around for a long time, we have the best conversion rate in New Zealand, I think, of almost anywhere.
Wow.
I actually have a question on a fairly popular children's, I think it was children's books, but maybe they implement games as well on the iOS. It's an iPad book store for kids, basically, in this app. And iOS has been getting a huge flack in the last month or so for kids, like, racking up $10,000 bills for purchases. And they decided this last week to go to subscription. So they said there's no such thing as in-app purchases. There's a subscription or not a subscription, and you have access to all content. I'm wondering, like, how does that affect you? Especially, I'm super interested in the kids, in the kids market, because you're not really selling to the kids, right? You've got to convince the parents that this is okay or that they like it as well. Yeah. But also those other nuances that how do you deal with in-app purchases with something like this?
Well, first I would say that you are selling to the kids, but you're giving the kids the tools to sell it to the parents.
Okay.
Because most apps for kids are selling to the parents, and that's why they suck. It's because they're clearly not made for the kids. They're clearly made by the man, for the man, to go and, look, we're educating your child, and we're giving them something substantive, so give us money. Right. Where if it had been made for fun, and by the way, we're also sneaking in some educational stuff, then it would not suck. Anyway, but as far as how that'll work, National Geographic has been trying this with their kids' magazine, with some of their other magazines. The subscription model, I don't know. I don't see it working with the types of interactive publications that are out right now. I don't think it's been broadly adopted yet. I think for kids' media, I think it's tough because the purchase so often is just, mom just wants to finish the dishes, or dad just wants to finish changing the baby, and can the 5-year-old just give him 15 minutes to do that? Mm-hmm. And all right, I'll get you $1.99 worth of gold coins to
go nuts.
But our hope is that, for one thing, parents are realizing that there are tools to create an allowance around this, and that it can be used to reinforce positive behavior, as well as just, if you're just going to use it as a babysitter, then it's no better than any other mindless babysitter.
Right.
You've got to
have them watch TV.
Yeah, you have to pay attention. We're building some parental tools for Animal Jam along these lines, so that parents have a lot of visibility into what kids are doing, and they can be as engaged as they want to be. What we found, though, and what the data overwhelmingly shows, is that parents always will respond to polls saying that they are deeply engaged in what their children do online. They pay a lot of attention to the games they play and everything.
Oh, God.
But then you look at the actuality, and they're not.
Right.
The scale is just is huge between how engaged they think they are, how they say they are, and how engaged, say, their kids think they are, or how much attention, does mom actually know what I'm playing online? I think, The Atlantic did an interesting story recently just on the effect of apps on kids and digital media on kids. And the conclusion after 100,000 words or so was that basically the best engagement you're going to get with kids and parents is if they're doing it together, if they're playing the stuff together. Mm-hmm. And not just, sitting on the couch next to each other and occasionally sending each other a text message, but, if they're actually engaged in something together. Reading together can be really rewarding on the iPad, because you've got interactive stuff that you can be playing with, and if the interactive books are good, that can be a really great experience.
Sure.
That's a really long-winded, and I don't think I even answered your question. I don't
remember the question. About the weather or something? I don't remember the question. But no, it's interesting. I guess another question I have is, when you wanted to be a writer and your story was important to you, what stories were you interested in telling? Because obviously the stories you're telling are focused towards children, and they're relatively simplistic in their nature. How does that, from what you wanted to what you're doing, how do you...
Yeah. it hasn't always been that way. You know, the games that we did with Beyond Games were, you know, we did more M-rated stuff and more, you know, apocalyptic kind of fiction stuff. And so I wouldn't say that got it entirely out of our system, but I like the fact that what we're doing now has some real substance to it, and I think that there are more nuanced and layered stories that we're going to start adding into the Animal Jam universe as we bring new titular characters out and we get more involved in kind of online and offline conservation programs that we can get kids involved in. But it's, it doesn't necessarily scratch the itch for me as far as the kind of writing that I do. So, when and if I ever have the time to do that again, I'll probably be writing more apocalyptic comedy of some kind.
Do you find things that scratch that itch now while you're working on this?
Are you
writing on the side or trying to do anything?
You know, I always find places where, you know, writing goes and you can have a lot of fun. There have been some scripts we've been working on lately for some short animations that we're going to do with Animal Jam characters, and those have been a lot of fun to noodle around with. And there's always some of that there. It's for both Chris, the other founder there, and I think if we're not engaged creatively with the stuff we're making, if we're just being, you know, the business guy or the tech guy or whatever, that's not why we started the company. Mm-hmm.
How big is your company right now, SmartBomb?
We are 60 something in Salt Lake. Mm-hmm. It's going up over the last couple of weeks, so I'm gonna put a pin in it and say 63 in Salt Lake, and about 23 in Seattle.
And I saw you guys at GDC, and it sounded like you guys are looking for a lot of positions in growing Seattle as well for new projects.
We are, yeah. And unfortunately, I think we're looking for the same people that everybody else is looking for, which is server engineers and database admins. And, you know, the reason being that, you know, it used to be when you were hiring game engineers, they were fairly specified in the games industry.
Right.
You know, there were specialities there that, you know, most people don't do physics simulations out there in the world. You don't compete with banks for guys that do FPS AI. But now we're competing with banks and, I don't know, gyms and supermarkets and everybody else who wants to, quote, put their data in the cloud. They all need the same sort of people that we do.
Interesting. But, I mean, you still have uses for those other game-specific engineers, but because it's more server-based, there's a lot more needed.
Yeah, but less than we used to, because, you know, we used to create all of our own engines and create our own tech from scratch, and we've reformed. We got better. We realized that there are, you know, teams of 50 people focusing on nothing but that, and that unless we want to try and compete with them, we could either make games or make engines.
Yeah,
right.
What do you guys use for engines? Is it some
We use Unity quite a bit right now. In the past, we do still work with some of our own proprietary tech. The last console game that we did was on our own engine. That was Snoopy Flying Ace. And the stuff that we're doing now, which is part of what the Seattle guys are working on. You know, we have this property, Sky Legends, that we've been developing for a while. It's browser-based, flight combat, kind of gameplay-wise, I'd say maybe Crimson Skies-ish. So, you know, easy to pick up. It's not a flight sim in the way that, you know, you're shooting at a targeting reticle 10 miles away. You never really... See, I'd say it's more like cart battle stuff blowing up in the skies.
Which is more fun anyway.
Yeah, lots of stuff blowing up. And that's something where we're using a combination of Unity and some of our own server tech and some of our own tools. Now a lot of our technical development just goes into tools and administrative stuff.
With Animal Jam being Flash, are you guys looking at migrating that to HTML5, or are you guys happy with where that's going to be for the next 5 years? Or
I wouldn't say for 5 years, and I don't know that HTML5, maybe in 5 years that becomes a real game platform. But there's too many people scrabbling over it, and I think there'll be too many other better alternatives by then. But you know, Flash obviously would, you know, it's approaching its sell-by date, and though you know, we have to take into account that at Animal Jam is international. We've got players in 100 different countries, and in a lot of countries, Flash is not only as ubiquitous as it is here, but it's probably got a lot of legs yet.
Interesting.
You know, it's going to be there for a while. But as we see, you know, it's certainly helping that our audience is moving to tablets on MOS. Future technology, Animal Jam obviously has to evolve out of 2D and out of Flash, and that's definitely part of the 5-year plan there.
Very cool.
Yeah.
Very cool. Anyone else have any questions?
I want to hear about what the undergraduate guy is doing building stuff. What are you making?
What am I making? Okay.
Yeah. Clark's now the interviewer here, so go ahead.
This is awesome.
It's great. His stuff sounds more exciting.
You should see what he's been making, and it is quite impressive.
Yes.
His game made my arms sore.
I'm a character artist.
It'll be explained momentarily.
Was it intended to?
kind of.
So yeah, we made a Guitar Hero kind of game. It's a brawler, but you're using a guitar, so it's just a different peripheral, you know.
Nice.
He's
not selling it right because he's not the producer. The pitch was: there's 25 million Guitar Hero guitars collecting dust. Yeah. Let's make a game that's not a Guitar Hero game that uses this controller.
It's smart.
I think that's what. Like when I hear that, I go, "Oh, that sounds so cool." So
I wasn't trying to sell my game.
I know. Unfortunately, you don't know the rules. Yeah, you need to be selling your game. All right. But no, it's
a cool concept.
It's a very cool concept.
I mean, that's why I actually care about the game. It's a great concept, and I was given a lot of leeway with, hey, you are the character artist, just make the world, and I was able to make something pretty cool. I love the style of everything I was able to do.
Nice.
And keep.
I like the level where you're walking in, like, knee-high
blood.
That's the last level, isn't it?
Yeah. That's pretty great.
Yeah.
That's where my arms
hurt. You're just a heavy metal
hold down a button and just strum like crazy.
That's awesome. Yeah.
So
it's a lot of play on, like, 80s, kind of like what you want. Every metal kind of thing. Imagination go wild.
That's cool. The first game that I worked on was an 80s fighting game with walking in bits of blood and all that. Yeah.
Oh, so much fun. I love ridiculous games, and it makes me happy to be a part of it a little bit.
Are you guys publishing soon?
Oh, we're up there. You're on XBLUG right now. Download it.
Oh, nice.
So Heroes of Rock, you should download it now.
Awesome. Yay for shameless plugging.
Yeah.
No, that's great. Clark, I'm curious what you think about what we're doing as academia, you know, the academic side of the scene. Because you didn't have this, right, when you back in your day.
Oh, no. No, I wish I had this amazing program here that you basically replicate what a game development studio looks and feels like, and you're making games. That's, you know, 10 years ago we were coming up to the U and talking to people up here, and they were saying, yeah, we've got some super advanced ray tracing that runs on supercomputers that you might be interested in. Well, when
does it run on the Xbox?
Yeah, exactly. We might be able to use this when, you know, the AIs years. Have taken over and everything. We can do real time ray tracing on a phone. But it's, you know, it's not really relevant to what we're doing. Clearly, they heard the call here for where the industry was going and where we needed people, because this is really cool. I think, you know, it'd be interesting to me, and you guys probably see more of this than I do, but it used to be that you would go to SIGGRAPH and you would get the hyper-academic perspective on graphics computing,
right,
and, you know, everything that's going on in that world. And here you've got more of the industry-driven digital media approach, and I don't know if there's still a place where those two collide, because GDC is still pretty 101 for a lot of what's talked about in there. Maybe in the programming track they get into it a little bit. I don't know that there's a place where that kind of, you know, here's the stuff going on in the ivory tower that you might not be able to use for 10 years, talking to the, you know, the John Carmacks of the world who are just kind of creating looking for new stuff, new features. Yeah.
Well, there was a woman yesterday that was from Casual Connect, and I got to go to that, and it was, someone described Casual Connect as the conference that you go to after you made your game that you were inspired by to make at GDC, and this is how you sell it, right? This is the business aspect of it. And she was saying that they're trying to get a whole bunch of indie game developers to kind of have a showroom of, like, here's all the crazy cool games that are being, you know, created by the people that aren't doing it for money, in a way. Do you think that's an approach that might inspire more people to look at what we're doing, or what? I don't know.
I hope so. You know what's going to inspire more people to look at what you're doing here is if people come out of here and start companies. The problem in Utah in this area is not lack of talent. We've got a ton of talent here. We always have. So many games are developed here because we had that talent from Evans and Sutherland, from all these other companies doing 3D. The problem is we don't have capital. And we don't have the capital network that you do in Silicon Valley. It's not as easy to go out and say, I've got this whack-ass idea for an iPhone game and someone's going to give you $100,000 to go try it out. We don't have that, you know, incubation sort of culture here. If we can develop that, and it's something that we do, you know, talk to the heads of other game companies here. We talk to the governor's office about this. This is something that we're very interested in inculcating, is that kind of culture of availability of capital. Because the guys who are coming out of this program shouldn't all be going and working for me or John at Disney or those guys. They should be starting companies, a lot of them, and working with each other.
Interesting. Do you think Kickstarter's an avenue for that? I wonder if Kickstarter's kind of hit its critical mass and there's not going to be much more, or it's going to get obviously a lot harder to get into, but... and I say this as Magnetic by Nature, one of the other undergrad games. They just posted a Kickstarter for their game.
Which is awesome.
It's doing extremely well. It's like 2,500.
Oh, yeah. They said they got backed by the Salt Lake City mayor.
Oh, my God. Yep.
Yeah, they're doing really quite well on that Kickstarter.
That is very good to hear.
Yeah, that's great.
I went to a GDC conference there, or a session, and they're like, this is how you get an NSF grant for $3 million. And I'm like, $3 million? I'd be happy with 50,000, you know, and sometimes I wonder, it would be great to go get some VCs from California that'll back me for $1 or $2 million. But I wonder if Kickstarter is showing us that we can kind of do this on our bootstraps with a little less money, and if there's opportunities there for smaller funding opportunity, kind of like micro lending, you know, was huge in third world countries, this micro funding that, I don't even know if that's a term or not. But am I on the right track, or what do you think?
I think there's something there, but, you know, you personally, or me personally, can't go get a $3 million NSF grant, because really you need a grant writer and you need people with the connections to put in the right places. Yes. And it, you know, there's an infrastructure of people who are hooked in there that you need to hook in with in order to make that happen. It's the same thing with angel capital or that. Mm-hmm. Ultimately, you know, I think it's going to become, to some degree, the same thing with Kickstarter. Yeah, you can, you know, you could probably put together a great video and raise $10,000 and do games on this scale, but, you know, if you need to raise, you know, $500,000, or you need to raise $1 million to do something that's, you know, going to look AAA to the rest of the world, that's hard to do unless, you know, you're Tim Schafer or you know, somebody like this, and you've got this name and pedigree to bring to it, and it's tough. Or you could spend your entire graduate program just making a video that's really funny and goes viral, and stake all your hopes on that.
Tried, that didn't work, so what else?
Yeah, I got to pay off my student loans.
That was 2 years.
Yeah. That was 2 years. A really terrible YouTube video.
It was 2 years. I guess I'll get a law degree.
Which, I have a friend that's a lawyer, and he says there's always law school, so...
Half my family is lawyers.
Oh, that's good.
And many of them that are graduating are considering law school.
I'm my condolences to them. Well, I guess, like, sometimes I keep getting this bug that keeps biting me. It's like, mate, you know, stop looking for a job. Just start. You've got ideas. You've got opportunities. Just
Take
out and do, we could do a company. And it scares the crap out of me. But, you know, funding is definitely something that's like, in the forefront of, like, how the heck would I be able to do this? Because I know I'm going to need a team. I know I'm going to need a group of people that are just as committed as I am.
Well, the advantage that you've got here is that you're surrounded by those people, right? I mean, you've got those connections, you're making them here in this program, and yeah, it's difficult to go out and say, all right, I'm going to make a game, I'm going to forge my own way, and you're like the dude that made Braid, and you spend 2 years, and you're kind of a dick to people, and then you're talking about something, and then, yeah, you earn the right to be a dick to people. But for most people, you know, it's the connections that you're making here. All right, I know some guys that do this. Let's get a band together. Let's eat ramen for 6 months, and let's make a game.
Yeah.
Because once you've done that, taking it to the next stage, you know, there are the competitions that you can enter it in. There are capital contests where, you know, we have some of those going on here in Utah. You know, we've got pitch competitions and things like that. Yeah, then the only ingredient that you need is somebody who can pitch well and can get up and babble about it and show some passion for it. But yeah, I mean, do it now rather than getting a job now while you don't have all the obligations and everything, while you're less tied down. You've got this network of cool people who also love this stuff. God, make a game. Make at least a couple. Otherwise, you're going to regret it, because you're going to go, all right, I'm going to go get a job, and I'm going to make a lot of money, and we're going to make some hits, and I'm going to get around to doing some stuff on the side. And
you never get back to it.
You're never going to,
yeah.
Well, I think we should end this now, because I'm getting too inspired, and my wife's going to hate me when I come home.
Oh, you've got a wife? Oh, yeah. That changes everything.
Oh, yeah. Okay. Okay.
Just ignore everything. Okay, we got a job. Okay.
I was checking, though, because I do have three little girls that...
Oh, man, okay.
It's really out the window.
Sorry,
yeah.
Sorry, Spence.
Why don't you go outside? I'll talk to Ethan.
Sorry, Spence. You can't be in the club anymore.
Oh,
you're out of
the
band.
He has a family.
No, you can totally... Yeah. You can totally do that.
And I guess the risk is a little higher for me because of the family, that I think that's what scares me more than, like, I could live off of ramen.
Well, they're little girls. They don't eat much. No. The bigger they get, the more they eat.
Yeah, and they don't...
Well, it depends. The bigger they get, the less they eat sometimes.
Yeah. Something to that. Yeah, it depends on...
Yeah, hope other not.
So, I guess, what's your take on... you know, these big studios, and there's a lot of kind of fluctuating that's going on with these names, but where do you think the industry is going with, I mean, smaller studios, bigger studios?
Yeah, we watched layoffs. I mean, even this past year,
yeah,
just a ton.
You
know, even last month, there was a bunch of layoffs, these big companies.
And they're
closing games over, like, mobile games. Playfish is practically gone. Well, you know, and by June, all their games are going to be gone.
Yeah.
I'm just like...
Yeah, it's tough. I would not want to be a big, spread-out publisher like that right now. I would much... You know, the new model is... I heard somebody describe Supercell as the new Valve, you know, both in terms of the company culture that they've created, but also in terms of just the way that they're very focused on creating the experience, and then you know, they drive value that way, and that's what it's all about. They're not really beholden to anybody else. They can make whatever they want. The game takes as long as it needs to. Not everybody can do that, but
right.
But you know, and in some sense, those are the companies. I mean, Supercell, two games, and they just took down money with a valuation of $770 million on two games. You know, that's, you know, so now you're getting into the territory of, you know, what used to be big publishers, the THQs, the Midways, and these guys who have a lot of IP, and you think they're a powerhouse. That doesn't bring them value. That IP is what gets auctioned off after you screw up and everything goes out of business, and then, you know, a bunch of Germans buy Homeworld, and who knows what they're going to do with it. the nimble are going to survive. The tough thing is, and you probably heard this talked about a lot, nobody really needs publishers right now, right?
Yeah,
right.
At least to make games, they don't need them. But in mobile, which is kind of where the gold rush is right now, it's getting much, much more expensive and difficult to acquire users. And until Apple comes up with a decent solution to versus Game Center, which is a mess. You know, it's going to be tough for that ecosystem to be as indie friendly as it could be. But yeah, I see more consolidation with more Asian companies are going to be closing up some of these publishers here, I think, for their IP. You know, there was a rumor a couple of years ago that Nexon was going to buy EA, and everybody kind of poo-pooed it all. That Nexon buy EA.
EA is much bigger than Nexon.
Now, there's half a dozen companies that, you know, pretty legitimately could step in and buy EA, and it's not really going to hurt their bottom line, and they do it just for the IP.
Yeah.
So... yeah, there's going to be consolidation, and there's going to be a lot of big names that we've all known and loved going away.
So you've distributed games through publishers then on consoles?
We have,
well,
yeah.
Right?
Yeah.
How's that been different with Animal Jam, because you do what you want?
Yeah, well, we kind of hit a point where we were work-for-hire console publishers.
And yeah.
The work-for-hire console publisher, their dream is always that they're gonna have a hit, and they're going to make enough money that they can tell all the publishers to go to hell, and they can make their own game. And but the deck is stacked against you there, and it very rarely happens. What we found is that the contracts we were used to doing, which were these $3 to $5 million development budget deals, usually cross-platform, just didn't exist anymore around 2007 because THQs and those kind of publishers, Namco's, companies that we'd been working with were going kaput. You know, now the console market was either very, very expensive games that could command a lot of shelf space, or very, very inexpensive games that could be done on XBLA profitably. And we were in the middle. We had to kind of pivot and convince our investors that, hey, now's the time for us to go out and acquire or create some of our own IP and build our own stuff. And that was what made the decision there. And yeah, it's tremendous. You know, it's working without a net, because you know, if we mess something up, then it's all on
us.
That's
it. Yeah.
Yep. You know, every developer has always said, oh, I made the best game, but if they just marketed it, they just put it on TV like they said it would, and we don't have that excuse.
Yeah. Right. Yeah.
So you mentioned investors, and I guess I'm curious, you know, I guess this is something that maybe is good to be aware of, that you don't run your company in the respect that you're answering to someone even though you don't have a publisher. Is that fair to say, or how does that relationship work between investors?
It works differently for different companies, and you know, the ideal investor relationship is where the employees or the managers still control the majority of the company.
Yeah.
Our relationship with our investors has been tremendous, and yeah, they control a lot of the company, but it's been very autonomous. They don't. You know, we get together pretty frequently. We tell them what's going on. They give us some advice, but they're not, you know, they're not setting company direction. Really, it's been a very synergistic relationship that way.
That's good.
Nice.
Yeah. I guess because you don't have the publisher, do you find yourself putting off updates, or you know, I thought about Riot Games where. Mm-hmm. They update when they want to, and they'll say, "Hey, we got a new champion coming out. When's it coming out? We'll let you know when it's ready.
Out.
You know, when it's ready." And I go, "Man, you know," and they're in a sweet spot that they can really, you know, push people's buttons, and no one cares. They're like, "I don't care, you're Riot." But I mean, Adam was like, "Don't bother Clark too much in getting him on the podcast, because we go in 2 week cycles and we can get really busy." And you know, I mean, at the end of those 2 weeks, if you're not confident with what that update is, do you push it out anyways, or
how? No, that's something where we have major new cool features for Animal Jam that have been in development for a year that we thought we would be launching this time last year, but they're not right yet, and we'll abandon stuff, or we'll continue noodling around with it, or we'll put it on hold, or that's the advantage of not having the publisher there.
But isn't that
more possible not because of the publisher, but because of the game as a service? I mean, how do I guess, because if you don't have a product out there, then you don't have a product out there. But if when it's an update,
yeah,
what's
well, there's
I guess, how do you deal with it?
You know, you've got the existing game, and mm-hmm. it's got updates that players expect. They expect, you know, every once in a while they're going to see a new animal avatar come in, they're going to see new accessories and dens and other stuff like that. It's the big updates, the big really cool stuff, like there's a new mini game or there's a completely new mode or a new world or something really big. That's the stuff that we can work on and spend a lot of time with, because oh, okay. we know that we can kind of keep players placated with, you know, this kind of tier 2 update content. And hopefully, you know, after you've been doing it for a couple of years with a world like this, and you're starting to take it international, and you can start recycling some stuff. And you can, you know, it's like running a theme park, and you put something in mothballs for a couple of years, and then you repaint it, and you trot it back out, and say, look, it's the brand new worldly gig, and people don't realize it. Yeah. Did that used to be purple? Yeah.
No. I'm not sure what to say. Well, someone else do a question. Well, ask Isaac something else.
Back to the original interview the way it was meant to be.
I actually have a question. Like, talking about, we keep on talking about games as service versus games as product. A lot, actually, specifically because of the Sim Social is closing up in June. Mm-hmm. A bunch of some other ones too, I think. And one of the big pushes they had was like, you know, spend all your money now because it's gonna be gone.
Yeah,
you know. And we talk about this a lot, especially because, you know, Riot with League of Legends and all these things, and in say 2-3 years, is this game still gonna be around? And you put all this money into it, is it just gonna disappear? You know, and you know, I can still go back and plug in my SNES, you know, and I can go play, you know, Donkey Kong Country or whatever, you know, and then, but like these games that we're putting all these, you know, you put money into, they're gone.
Not necessarily. So, you can also go still play EverQuest. Or
that's true. Yeah, or that's true.
Games like that. I think there's a problem with companies not designing their games to last that long, or designing the properties that they're based on to last that long. You shouldn't be designing to, you know, to cash in on a quick surge around the holidays and get out. You designing games as a service means, you know, you should be designing something that should still be around in 10, 20 years.
Hmm. So is that something that you're conscious of then?
Yeah.
How do we make sure that this will, because if you shut those servers off, I can't play Animal Jam.
Right.
You know, and if my daughter says, 10 years ago, I loved playing Animal Jam. I want to see if that's still around. Oh, dang it!
Yeah,
you know, I mean, like, how do you? That's something. I don't know if you can answer that question.
No, that's something that we talk about a lot, actually, because it's when we first decided to partner with National Geographic on this, and you know, that was we approached them and said, hey, this is kind of the idea that we have, and we thought it would be cool if we licensed the National Geographic logo from you guys, and what they offered us was, you know, was a lot more. Okay, yeah, you can license our logo, but we'll also give you all this cool video and all this other stuff. Mm. And what we said at the time, and I think still holds, is that we weren't trying to, you know, create the next Club Penguin or the next, you know, whatever. What we were trying to do is create the next Sesame Street, the next kids' IP that would actually have enough depth and weight that it could last for 50 years. And I want my grandkids to play Animal Jam. It's not going to look like it does now. Sesame Street doesn't look like it did when,
right.
yeah. when I was a kid. But there are tropes about it that are consistent. And, you know, it's something that hopefully kids who are now playing are going to let their kids play because they remember the experience they had and they know that it had some value.
Okay. Do you think EA didn't have that foresight?
I don't think EA takes that approach. They're driven by, you know, the shareholders and by financial concerns, and those, you know, those are real concerns. Mm-hmm. There are a lot of people at EA I know who want to take that approach, and you know, I think that it's going to be an existential thing for a lot of large companies. They're either going to start taking that approach or they're gonna get hurt. You know, EA really got a black eye from that PR-wise, and it's going to be hard for people to trust their other online services or things.
Yeah. So I think this was actually an MBA student. It wasn't even related to games, but they were lamenting about how game companies just aren't innovative because they're so worried about the quarterly profits or the quarterly numbers or the quarterly reporting that they won't do anything that takes longer than 3 months to do. Mm. Do you think that's
it's part true
of that?
It's true of a lot of companies, yeah. But okay. I don't think it's true of companies that are going to have longevity. It's not. I mean, you can see the difference in the products. You see the copycat stuff on iOS.
Yes.
You see the ones that are pretty much they're just Skinner boxes. They're not really even games. Yeah. They're just kind of behavioral pills and compulsory. I think that the wave's going to crest on that. It's going to pass. It already did on those types of games in Facebook, and already jumped the shark with the Ville games. And I don't think you're going to get the same people to come in and spend the same money on those games because now they know what it's all about.
Yeah.
And the same thing's going to happen with the iOS stuff and the Match 3 games, and whether you make it out of candy or sparklers or fireworks or whatever it is, that the wave is going to crest on that, and something else is going to come back.
Plus, I remember going to, I don't know if you ever attended the Push Button Summits.
Mm-hmm.
2 years ago, we went to one, and there was a talk specifically talking about whales and fish, and like how you have the free-to-play market users, you have your whales who kind of are your heavies, and they spend thousands of dollars on these games and stuff. And I thought about that at the time. I was like, that's really great until they figure that out. And once that gets old, what happens to the free-to-play market? is it that just...
Well,
does that still hold true, or is it still...
Maybe.
Is it changing?
There are people who spend a lot of money watching movies.
Sure.
Or, if this is something that they do and they get a lot of satisfaction out of, and then a lot of their social connections are in it, then it's not a bad investment for them in many cases.
But I have issue with certain games that I've seen, and these are definitely not the A-list games, but I'll see games and I go, I want to see what their pricing model is and figure, okay, $99 for this many gems. And then I figure it would take me about $4,000 to reach a level of max ability in this game. And it's like, wow, I would have to spend $4,000. That does not sound, I guess, fair or reasonable in their pricing model, other than they know if we keep hitting you with, nicks, we can get you up to $4,000. You won't even realize it. And that just feels very deceptive, as opposed to, sure, we'll keep giving it to you. We have no problem providing you the service and paying in you as long as you keep paying for it. But it seems like the pricing models are just completely all over the place.
Yeah, well, and I should say, we apply a lot of analytics, a lot of business intelligence to Animal Jam, and to what kids are doing in Animal Jam. We know what they're playing. We know what types of content is more likely to get them to talk mom into a membership. We know what they like to spend their gems on. We know that stuff. We have to, because if we're deciding, all right, are we going to make this piece of content a new den, or are we going to make a new animal, or what are we going to make? It's partially driven by what's going to engage kids, and partially driven by what the analytics tell us is more likely to be a return on investment.
Yeah.
But that said, what we're doing is we're looking for what surprises and delights our users, and we're trying to offer them more of that, and expect that we'll make more money, organically from doing so. There are a lot of companies out there that are driven just by the analytics, and it's pretty cutthroat. It looks great. I would love to make $2 million a day off an iPhone app or something, but really, I don't want to make money that way. I would feel a lot better about it knowing that people were having fun doing what I was doing, and maybe sometimes they curse themselves for putting one more quarter in the machine or whatever, but it was because they were having fun and not because we'd found some sort of heroin receptor in their brain and we were just tickling it callously and they couldn't get to it.
Well, it even seems like I'm okay with someone going to an arcade and popping quarters all day, and they may pop $40 in that day.
But for some reason, I don't know why, that seems more reasonable to me than, you know, $50 packets that you can buy at a time. That, I mean, like, yeah. the fact that there's an option for $50 and $99, yeah. You know, in-app purchase, yeah. makes me go, are people really buying this? And if so, really?
Well, I mean, like, I think that was the difference, right? It's like, I mean, I grew up in arcades.
Yeah.
You know, but you always knew what you were getting for that quarter. Mm-hmm. You're going, I'm getting another turn. Mm-hmm. I know exactly, it's up to me, it's my skill that if I, however long this quarter lasts, right? As opposed to, you know, you pay 50 gems for a stick.
Does the stick matter? That was the perception that you had.
Right.
Yeah. Everything about the design of that game and all of the conversations that went into the design of that game were how to get your next quarter.
Yeah.
Not how do we create a scenario in which your skill can reward you with continuous free play.
Sure.
Yeah.
Well, I think that's perception, right? I mean, like, because a lot of times you look at free-to-play games, like, you can get this sword, and this sword is much better than the free one that you could get by spending this much time getting there. But it's not really, because there's another better one, like, five levels up.
Yeah.
You know, and, like, and that thing is not suddenly worthless. I mean, I look at just some of the free-to-play models, especially on mobile games and things like that, and they're just so... It just doesn't feel right. You know, it just...
Well, again, if you're going to create properties or games or even a company that's going to last 10, 20, 30 years, you can't treat your customers like that.
Yeah.
You know, they've got to... They can come away going, wow, I spent more than I intended to, but that was fun, and, you know, that was great. But if they come away feeling like, you know, they were just ripped off, they were just taken advantage of, or their kid, even worse, their child was taken advantage of. Maybe you got their money, but you burned that bridge, and you poisoned your name.
Do you think it's just going to kind of root itself out?
As it has with Facebook, and
sure.
I think that wave will crest and go away. We're already seeing, we see it happen at much faster cycles in Asia. You know, we see it happen in China when a new game comes out and starts to monetize well. There are 10 copies within 2 weeks. You know, 10 clones of that game.
When you say monetize well, that the players feel satisfied, or that they're making a horse?
They're making money.
Okay.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. They're making money. So, you know, there it's just in a hyper sped up cycle where if there's not real quality there, if there's not real substance there, you're not going to retain customers.
Yeah.
See, I love the idea of, like, you create this environment that's everyone loves. I mean, I love League of Legends too much, and I do respect buys. I go, all right, I like you this much, I'm going to buy blank, and I don't feel bad about it. I'm like, you know what, you provide an amazing service. I like the idea of, like, also being part of National Geographic and all this. Mm. You get this, in my head, you get respect buy from me, and I know a lot of people that's like, not only am I getting this little thing, but I'm supporting these guys. And I think that's the future of, you know, I spent a lot more money on certain games, a lot more than $60.
Yeah.
But I don't feel any bad about that. But I do feel bad about buying some random $60 game that I don't like that much.
Yeah.
So Shellraiser, the guys that created that mobile game, are you familiar with that one?
No.
It's a mobile game that kind of just hit the last couple months, and they talked to GDC about how to be an indie game developer and not lose your soul, was, I think, the title of their session. And one of the things was, they said, you've got to stop talking about your customers as whales. He's like, whales is out of the table. You're not allowed to say that anymore. And that was one thing. And then the other thing is, we were never allowed to say the word, how do we monetize our people, our customers, right? And yet they came up with what I thought was a fair solution to saying, we're going to satisfy two users, skill-based users and time-based users. Those that don't have the time, they can opt out to purchase to speed things up.
Yeah.
And it wasn't like, oh, you wait 8 hours to make your jacuzzi bubble faster. Yeah. It was just like, I don't have the time to grind to get the abilities that I need. I'll just buy some money and then I'll get the abilities. But and that game, I think you could probably spend about $10 and get just about everything you needed to out of the game.
Yeah.
And be satisfactorily able to progress through everything. Where skill-based players, they said they tuned the game so that you can get through the entire game without spending a dollar.
Mm-hmm.
And I guess I'm curious on that comment. Is
Do you let them have all the content, or where do you find that gate?
I don't like gates, but
yeah. And I appreciate the sentiment behind what they're saying there, but I don't think that you can avoid talking about monetization when you've got people who are working for you, who's
it's a livelihood.
Depends on you. And, yeah, real jobs, real impact. If something happens there, and, you've got to look at the stuff that's going to make money. But absolutely, if you're building for the long term, you're not building something that's rapaciously going to get $50. I'd rather give you a great experience for $10 and have you feel like you've got value for that money than make a quick grab of $50 and run away and I just don't care if I'm going to ever hear from you again.
Yeah.
You
know?
Do you keep that in mind and go, okay, how do we do 5 instances of $10 purchases down the road versus a $50 grab? Or is it just I'd be happy with $10 and their confidence that we're a valuable resource to come to?
The consideration there is how much did it cost us in the first place to get that user to the door.
Yeah.
We do think about it in terms of what is it, what does the average have to be? It has to average out where, the average revenue per paying user is going to need to be about this, or we're going to be losing money on server costs and everything else. We can't support, too many more free users than paying users without going out of business. So we do think about it in terms of that, but the only way to think about that in terms of that, I think, successfully for the long term, is to think about what is that individual experience. Are you giving value for the money? It's the difference between selling, a fake Rolex on the street corner and, making watches by hand and charging more for them. It's pretty simple economics, but I think that the gold rush sensibility of free-to-play games right now has overshadowed that the way that it did in Facebook. And it was like, a couple of years ago, you could go in Silicon Valley and you can get a lot of money just saying, we're going to make Facebook apps. We've got all these guys, we're going to make Facebook apps, and they go, great, okay. Money. You can't get a dime for that now in Silicon Valley.
Well, it's almost becoming hard to do the same thing for, we're going to make a phone app, mobile app and people are...
Because then the question is going to be, okay, how are you going to attract users to it? Do you have a partner for that? Or how are you going to... where's the money going to come from for the ad networks or... Yeah, it's a tough bid, but this is something that we're asked all the time. And I might be wrong in this, and you guys might shoot me down with counterexamples immediately, but I can't think of any truly great game on iOS or mobile platforms that has failed to find an audience. I can't think of anything really awesome, that kind of moved the needle on awesomeness, that for some reason nobody played it.
Right.
It just sank beneath the waves. If you make good stuff, it will find an audience. It might take a little bit longer, it might take some patience, and you might not grab as much cash in the first month as the people who are approaching it more rapaciously. But if you make good stuff in general, it'll find an audience.
Some people like quality. for anything.
Yeah, and they can tell the difference.
I guess I failed to ask, what do you do right now as a CEO? Are you... Where do you have your hands in development? Do you get to play with the designers a lot?
Not as much as I like to. Right now, I'm probably more just bogged down in business and legal stuff than I would normally like to be. Part of it is we've got a couple of external partners that we're working with, and a partnership that we're trying to create in China right now, and. We're trying to get Animal Jam positioned internationally, and so that involves a lot of contracts and a lot of talking to business people and not talking about fun stuff. And so right now that's a lot of the day to day. It's a lot of planning and strategizing where we're going next, sure, but not as much game design as I would like. Yesterday we had a great meeting. We were looking at a bunch of new iOS prototypes, and we were riffing on those and saying we came up with a completely different direction. We're like, let's go that direction. Now everybody's excited about that. That's fun, and that that makes all the contracts I have to read worth it.
I actually talked to a designer at Smart Bomb last year, and he lamented about how he has this great idea for this feature, and he's like, it's going to work. And everyone's like, no, it's not going to work, and because there's no data backing that. If we make this decision, and I'm not. This isn't intended to call you on the carpet, but I've asked people since then, because I thought that's a really interesting conundrum. That we're so analytics driven. How do we deal with? I just know this design will be fun, right? And there was one good response that I got when I went to a conference, and they said, "Well, that designer's an idiot because he should be able to prove." He should be able to figure out analytics and have data prove that that design was fun. And I'm wondering what your thoughts on that. Like, there should be a way that you can prove. And I guess the same way that you said, we know what people are buying, thus that must mean that that's fun. Or
well, we don't use analytics to determine fun.
Okay.
We use analytics to determine what types of players. Tend to spend money in the game, and what sort of content do we need to provide in order to keep the service going. Mm-hmm. But in general, if we have a lot of free players in there and engaged for a long time, so yeah, the stats that you'll see quoted in the media for virtual world or online games, we'll talk about how many registered users they have, and it's totally meaningless. You can get as many registered users as you're willing to pay for. It's a PR stat. It means nothing.
Yeah.
What matters is how engaged are they? How much time are they spending per play session? How long do they stick around? How long do they keep coming back to the game? On average, kids are spending over 65 minutes per play session in Animal Jam.
Free.
These are 8-year-olds.
These are free users.
Yeah, these are free users.
Holy crap.
So, now if you can hold an 8-year-old's attention for a 24-minute TV show, you're doing pretty well. They're in play. And the game logs you out after 30 seconds if you're not doing anything. It's not like they're putting it on like TV and doing their homework. They're engaged with it, you know, in a very deep way. It's socially important to them. It's fun important to them, hopefully educationally important to them. So the decisions that we make might just be about engagement. It might be not about, is this going to make money? It's going to be more about, we've got players in the game that really want a questing component to it. You know, and we think that we can get more players and different types of players if we engage them with this. Let's do that. It doesn't translate to us, if we do this, we're going to make a bunch more money. It translates to this that if we do this, it's going to be more fun. People are going to stay in there longer. And naturally, that evolves into, that turns into more money eventually. But then, the lament of the designer there is a common thing around game companies, and it's tough. You know, we try not to make fun decisions based on analytics. We try to make those based on what we think is fun.
Sure.
And sometimes, we're a bunch of the older people, and sometimes we got to bring kids in, and we need to listen to what they say.
Yeah.
And that's something that we've done a lot of, too. I've been that designer. I've been the guy who was like, I know this is going to work. I know this is going to be fun. They just won't try it because they don't get the vision. They don't see what I'm seeing.
Yeah.
And that's the challenge is, if you can help somebody get the vision and see what you're seeing, then you can usually convince them of it.
Yeah.
But, if you just say, I think it'd be cool if you were a monkey and you were in the city and you could jump over buildings. And then, where's the camera perspective? What's my objective? Can I break buildings? Or I'm just jumping over buildings? But that person has got a vision for that. You know, they know what the controller feels like in their hands. They know what they're seeing on screen. They know what the music sounds like. You've got to get that across.
Yeah. You can't just have a vision. You've got to be able to express it.
Yeah.
Is that more of an answer? The answer to that is they should be able to successfully prototype this so that they can show you in whatever form it is that's needed.
Sometimes that prototype is more just expressing it well.
Okay.
And we've tried over the years to put together some different templates for how to, if you're a non-game designer, how to bring a design idea.
Oh, neat.
Where we kind of ask a series of questions of, you've got an idea for a game. And usually what we hear are ideas for stories. They're not ideas for games. Yeah.
It's very, very common.
And it might be a great idea for a story, and if, you know, if we're not jumping on it, they'll come away frustrated. Oh, they're not getting it. It's because, you know, the game is what we need to visualize, and that means, you know, what am I doing from moment to moment? What is the core fantasy that's being satisfied? What are the basic controls? What are the key, you know, what are the core mechanics? Where's the camera? What am I looking at? You know, how are you teaching the player what they need to do? It's questions that designers ask themselves that storytellers don't necessarily.
Did you ever get to a point where you're like, I feel like more of a game designer than a storyteller?
Yeah, because I've had to kill a lot of ideas that I've really loved that were more story than gameplay, and you get attached to that. And, you know, I constantly have to go in and, you know, if I had my druthers, there would be pages of dialogue and there'd be tons of text, and you know, I've got to go in and cut all that. I've got to look at it from the perspective of, you know, who I think the player is.
Sure.
Interesting. Well, I think we could keep going on for quite
a few more. It's getting dark out there.
Yeah. Automatic lights. Yeah.
The motion capture guy is coming in. He's going to do some CD when we're not looking.
But I think we better wrap it up, and maybe we'll have to bring you on some other time, because this is very valuable. This is great for us to understand a lot of the business stuff that honestly, this feels more stuff from the Ivory Tower, because it's hard to get someone like you to talk to us about all these these numbers.
I love talking to you guys. I love what you guys are doing here, and I hope that you guys go out and start some really cool companies and do some really cool stuff.
Well, that's a good motivation. I've got a really depressing call into my wife now to let her know what I'm going to be doing, unfortunately. So I'm going to give her your number afterwards.
Sure.
Told me to do it.
I just feel it. I feel
it. It was all Clark's fault.
Why didn't you get my idea? It's not a story, I swear. we'll wrap this up. Thanks to have Clark Stacey on, and Isaac, what's your last name?
Isaac Wood. It's too easy. That's
it is. I've known Isaac for about a year now, and all I know is all your handles on video games are Isaac, so I don't even know if you have your last name.
Isaac,
I-Z-A-C.
Yeah, I like to keep it complicated like that.
Yeah, thank you for that. But thanks for coming. So thanks for listening to Confessions of a Game Dev podcast. We love to hear from you, so... you can get a hold of us on Twitter at GameDevConfess, Facebook.com/ Isaac.
For me?
Yeah. What is it? No, what's our Facebook page?
I was like, what do you mean?
What's our Facebook page?
We want to see your vacation picture.
Oh. Yeah, I'm not putting my Facebook. But
we put all the guests on the spot. Oh, okay. So Facebook.com/
Right.
and
nailed it.
Good guess.
Our email address is.
I'm not giving you my Facebook.
No.
I'm going to.
Social security number is.
GameDev@confess.com.
Close. So close.
GameDevConfess@gmail.
Okay.
And our website, Ashley, sing us off.
GameDevConfess.com.
Yeah.
Whoa. I think that's the only thing I said this whole podcast.
Yay. Thanks, Ashley. You're talking.
That's what happens when you're an introvert.
Yes. But your comments are always valuable, because we never would have known where our website is. Now I know where to put this up.
Oh my gosh.
I'm so proud.
Yes.
But Animal Jam, it's on.
Oh yes.
Where can we find it?
AnimalJam.com. Uh-huh. It's free to play. TunnelTown.com. You can see screenshots and read about TunnelTown, which will be coming to iOS in another 3 or 4 weeks.
Cool.
And shortly thereafter, it will come to Android and other languages and things.
Okay.
And if you go to smartbombinteractive.com, you'll see some of the flight combat and other stuff we're working on. Your wife's calling.
Oh, my God.
Chucks it on the ground.
Your ears were burning.
Very cool.
Is this going on?
Yeah. All right. Well, cool. Right. Thank you very much.
Yeah. Thanks, guys.
Thanks for listening. See you guys later. Bye.
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 All right.